What's up, folks? This is Mike Biggs, your interim music director here at KPFA. I recently attended the Portola Music Festival, a massive two-day event that is relatively new in the festival circuit. Starting out in 2022, got off to a bit of a rocky start considering the time, COVID, and everything, but it has found its footing with the last 2 years. This was my first time attending Portola. I went with Greg Garza, host of KPFA's Indie Landscapes, who was in fact the person that initially inquired to me about getting press passes. As the current interim music director at KPFA, this was my first time attempting to get a press pass, and hey, it worked. Just a few weeks prior to the event, I got that glorious email saying we had been given the green light to cover Portola. 2024 is the first year this festival also completely sold out of tickets, which is incredible considering this event is almost 2 months after the widely popular Outside Lands. If you've never been to Pier 80, I do have to say the amount of space there is massive. Right by the water and next to some giant cranes, battleships, it's kind of perfect for a music festival. I have to admit, I'm not really the music festival type. I've never been to Coachella, Outside Lands, EDC, really any of them. In fact, the only festival I ever went to was Rock the Bells. But Portola, as overwhelming as it can be, reminded me why there's so much fun to go to. Music really is intended to be blasted at that level that can cause the bass to make your body vibrate. I had the opportunity to sit down with a couple of artists in the media tent. I first caught up with West London-based Lava La Rue, who's been touring promoting their debut album, Starface. What's up, everyone? This is Mike Biggs here with KPFA representing, and we are at Portola Music Festival. You know, for the longest time, I used to call it Portola because I went to a middle school called Portola, and it's spelled the same way. But, okay, Portola. It's one of the big music festivals, and I am joined by the incredible Lava La Rue. And I loved your set earlier. You were rocking it up on stage, and you were vibing really hard. I love that set that you were throwing down. Can you talk to me about the concept and the creation of your incredible album, Starface?
Yes, I can. I wanted to do a concept album for my debut album, which is Starface, and I kind of had this idea of a gender-fluid space alien who gets sent to planet Earth to understand why humans are so self-destructive, and the album just kind of plays out all of these kind of musical thoughts on that narrative, and it ends with an ultimatum.
I actually read, too, that it's you were kind of channeling a lesbian Ziggy Stardust.
It has been said.
So Bowie was definitely a bit of an influence on creating some of this record.
Yeah, I think not even particularly sonically, but just in terms of like the curation of an alter ego and making something that feels, yeah, otherworldly.
And I do want to talk about the song Push and Shove, but I also want to talk about hats. Because literally and figuratively, you have a lot of hats. I noticed that, especially in the Push and Shove video. You were rocking some great looks, but also some amazing hats in there, like some really big hats. And right before I hit record, we were talking about the 90s aesthetic, and I was wondering if any of the 90s had any inspiration with some of the looks, because I remember reading that the song was inspired by Tom Tom Club, and, you know, Genius of Love is a classic, and that's the 80s, but when I saw the hats in Push and Shove, I was like, oh, it reminded me of two things, Four Non-Blondes and the movie Clueless.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think, yeah, I was definitely trying to attempt to channel more of like an 80s new wave nostalgia. But I also love the intersection of 2000s new waves, where you had people kind of recreating the 80s, but from the perspective of the 2000s or even the early 2010s. And that was like such a thing, like 80s became cool again. And yeah, whatever decade you're a teenager in, whatever was cool 20 years ago, that's cool again. So everyone in 2010s was like, I'm a 90s babies. In the 2000s, it's like, I'm an 80s babies. Like now, my generation, it's like Y2K baby, you're 2000 baby. So yeah, I hope that answers your question about hats.
Yeah. I'm assuming your hat game is like crazy fierce.
Do you know what? I really appreciate your appreciation for my hat appreciation. Because not many people notice that, but I do, I love a good hat. My Latvian auntie on my dad's side, my dad's older sister, she's a miller. I think it's the right word, a hat maker. So I have a fondness for good hats.
I used to rock a lot of hats back in the days, and then I kind of stopped. But I appreciate anyone that can wear the hat and make it look good, just do it. Although today I noticed like you only had the beanie on for a little bit, and then you kind of went hatless for a while. But maybe it's because it was too nice outside to wear a giant hat, and maybe it was too warm earlier. But I like the beanie.
Yeah, do you know where I was? I'm on the like last three shows of a big tour, and I feel like I've worn every hat under the sun. That today I think my head just wanted a beanie.
Nothing wrong with that. Now I do want to talk about the song, which also in the video had another amazing hat, the song Shell of You, which incredible record, by the way. And that song, I'm bringing it back to the 90s and the aesthetic of it, because you're wearing the Oasis shirt. And when I heard that song, it just reminded me, it took me back to the era of massive crowds, lighters in the air, Wonderwall high and dry. It's got that vibe to it. So tell me about the creation of that song.
I really went into the studio. So this Shell of You was the very last song written on the album. Very, very. And it was made incredibly last minute, like a few weeks before we started mixing and mastering it. And I walked into the studio and I was like, right. And the actual studio we were recording in, it was closing down. So it was the last ever record made in that shit, Dirty Hit Studio, which is the label I'm with. And I was like, this is the last day of the studio, this is the last song of my album, I just want to make a song that's like the perfect song. That just feels like a pure, like just a songwriter's song. Like sometimes I make a song and it's a groove or it's a vibe, but I just want to like songwrite. So we did no computers, nothing, we just did guitar and piano. And we just started and we were like, we need to write the whole song on guitar and piano, have the perfect chords, and then we'll add lyrics, production, all that stuff. But once we've got that, then we'll like build up around it. And yeah, that's how that song was made. I wanted to make a song the way like the Beatles would have made a song. Yeah.
So that studio, were there any like legendary records that were recorded there? I'm sure there must have been.
Yeah, it's the Dirty Hit Studio. So like 1975 had recorded there. Who else on the label? Like Bieber Doobie had recorded bits there, Pale Waves. Yeah, like all of the main artists on the Dirty Hit roster had like done bits, whether that was even just finishing stuff or recording like a drum sound or whatever. Yeah.
Now, I do want to talk about the song Humanity, which a beautiful record. And I also did like the, I don't know if it was intentional, the nod to, it sounded like a nod to Lou Reed, Walk on the Wild Side, in the hook. I'm one of those weirdos. Yeah. So like I'm very like hardcore like music dude that like I hear crazy things that other people miss, and I've been called out for it before too. Like what's up with your ears? And I'm like,
What you just picked out, those are the things that I spend like a lot of meticulous time on working on, but I kind of just do it for me because I know that nobody's going to notice it. So it's nice when someone does. With the Lou Reed reference, what I really liked about it is, do, 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 is those backing vocals, they actually fade out in the track. They go do, 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 like that. And I just thought every time I listen to this, I'm like, whoa, it's like it fades out during the chorus every single time. And I was like, I need that. I want that on my song. Yeah.
Now I have to listen to it again just to hear that specifically, because I don't think I caught that, the fade out. That's very subtle. But in terms of like the content of the record, I mean, how was it important to record this song? Because, I mean, I noticed you had like the flags for Palestine that was in there. And I mean, there's so much going on in the world, but it felt like a record you had to get out.
Yeah, 100. It wasn't initially going to be a single on the records, and the single that was going to come out then was like a bit more upbeat, but like at the time it was just, I mean, it still is, like things were so bleak, and it feels weird as an artist trying to self-promote when there's like children getting bombed left, right and center. Every time you open the news, it's like something really dark, and it feels weird to like see that and then go on your story and be like, hey guys, so here's my new record. Like it feels weird, like it feels weird even just existing and knowing that that's happening simultaneously. I knew that like regardless, like it's still so important to use your voice or platform for good and create a good message. So I wanted to get that song out because I was doing a fund. My best friend, Big Pig, she was doing a Gaza Aid fundraiser, and I wanted to get it out so I could perform it at the fundraiser, which we did, which is the music video. And then I got fans to send in their own content, and many fans had been at protests. I didn't even necessarily be like, it has to be of any specific. Yeah. I was just like, just here's the song, what do you feel? And loads of fans sent in like them going to protest, and it just all came together in that way. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because I can tell you out here, like, the whole thing with Gaza has been going on for so long, and every once in a while it gets big in the news. People act like they care, but nothing happens. But then last year with the college campuses, that put it on such a global level that it was undeniable. And at the station I work for, that is one of our main things that we cover, is like actual real coverage on Palestine and not what corporate mainstream is telling you, which is very one-sided and basically just giving, you know, Israel just pats on the back. And not being critical.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, someone, did you have like any issues at all from where you're from having like, you know, sort of like any roadblocks by being where you are politically with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, the UK is equally as like complicit in this. Like, we sell so much arms like to the conflict that's happening. And it's very difficult because it does mean that there is censorship when you play live. When we perform live, there are things that we aren't allowed to say on stage at specific festivals or specific venues, because that will get those small venues at risk of closing down. And people could look at the venue and point at the venue and be like, you're really, because I'm not allowed to say like from the river to the sea or through Palestine or things like that. But the it's actually not the venues to be pointing at. They're just getting their license taken away from something that is a wider issue. Because, you know, things, what can constitute as hate speech these days has massively like changed essentially.
Yeah.
And it's difficult because we need to be at a situation as creatives where we can just have open conversations, and it's hard for people to have open and impartial conversations if the media that they're getting is one-sided or there are things that you can and can't say. Like, I think it's important for every side for people to be able to just know what the facts are, and that's what's really difficult, is finding a source point where it's like, these are the actual just facts of what's happening, do you know what I mean, and let people work from there of rebuilding. That's the only way you can have progression.
Definitely. Yeah, cause like Macklemore, I don't know if you've heard about him.
Yeah.
He just got kicked off a bunch of tours just for saying America.
Yeah,
and like,
course,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So censorship is unfortunately alive and well.
Yeah.
Now, switching up the topic a bit, as I mentioned, you wear hats, a lot of hats. One of those, though, is your directing hat. Because I read that you were also quite the accomplished music director, as a music video director as well. So I'm wondering, like, are we going to eventually see you move to film?
I don't see myself being like a touring artist in my 40s. Like, I would very much love to transition into a world where I can work like project by project and be a bit more still. I'm very much enjoying traveling right now, and there's points where I'm like, this is really nice, but I definitely don't think I could do this for like another 20 years. And so yeah, I would love to sort of like transition more into the sort of directorial world. And directing is one of the few careers in the entertainment industry where the older you get, generally the more respect you get. Any other form of like entertainment, being a model, an actor, a musician, there's kind of this like pressure point on youth and, you know, people finding you attractive or desirable, whereas like, I mean, and that's obviously all bullshit, but yeah, with directing, like, the older you get, the more power you command, which is great. Yeah.
And speaking of movies, I know that the theme of this album is very much aliens from outer space coming here to Earth. So what is your favorite movie about aliens?
Oh, that's such a good one. Yeah, I've got loads. I mean, I do genuinely love the, and I really wasn't expecting to love it, the most recent Alien film that came out.
Romulus was dope.
It was really good because the actual original director, like Ridley Scott, directed it. It had a British cast. The humor was, it was actually good. They went for a full cycle. So, sorry, that isn't my favorite, but that's just one at the moment that I was just so impressed and blown away because I was expecting it to be trash. There are some good sort of like cult, British cult ones. There's a British cult alien film called Attack the Block, and it happens in like, yeah, an urban British environment. And it was the first time I'd ever seen like an alien film outside of Doctor Who, like a movie set in like an urban British environment. Yeah.
I think I found out about that because of, why can't I remember his name? Oh my God. Yeah, because at that point he'd already been in Star Wars. And
yeah, he had been in Star Wars as well, yeah.
So I was like, that's what made me watch Attack the Block, and I loved it. It's a great film.
Yeah, and it's so like, it's so 2000s London, like UK vibes, which is such an era. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of the UK, London's 2000 vibe, you think we'll ever get like a garage record from you? I heard like a little bit of a drum and bass rhythm when I was on the album, but I'm like a hardcore OG two-step garage nut. Like, I got records in my garage. I got a bunch on my... when I DJ, every once in a while I even play two-step in my clubs. But
if you want to sound like an English two-step fan, you have to start calling it UKG or garage. It's not garage. It's
I know. That's actually my fault because I know better. I know that it's garage, and it's just
garage,
like...
garage, man. It's got to be garage. Yeah.
That's on me. That's my bad. I know better for that one. 20 years, I know that one, but slip of the tongue. And finally, and I appreciate the time, what can we expect from you next?
Yeah, I just want to grow this project bigger and better. Like, even though I've technically been putting out music for, like, you know, since I was 16, and if you go to my old SoundCloud stuff, you will find my garage songs. I just want I want to be able to take my full band out here. I want to be able to, like, yeah, direct bigger music videos. I want to just be able to play more festivals on bigger stages, and I just want to, you know, show people what I can do, and I feel like I'm just starting on that kind of journey, basically, yeah.
Your band is fire, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I wish that, and it's such a stripped back version. If you could see the five piece, it'd just be amazing.
Well, Lava La Rue, I appreciate your time, and great sitting down with you. And thank you again for being here, and hope to see more from you in the future. Start it up.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for having me.
All right. Again, Lava La Rue, their album Starved Face is available now. And I also managed to, at the very last minute, snag an interview with LP Giobbe, whose new album, Daughter, spelled D-O-T-R, is out now, and the story behind creating this debut album is very personal for her. What's up, folks? This is Mike Biggs here at KPFA at the amazing Portola Festival on day number 2. The weather is a bit nicer, it's a bit sunnier, it's not as cloudy, it's probably going to get cold later, but you know what, right now it's really nice weather and I'm enjoying it. I'm here with the fabulous, the one and only LP Giobbe in the place to be.
Thank you for having me.
Glad that you are here, and thank you for taking the time out to do this interview. I really, really appreciate it. So, I do want to start off by talking about your forthcoming album. You have an album in the works, and what can you tell us about it? What can we expect from this album?
Yeah, the album is called Daughter, D-O-T-R, pronounced daughter. Comes out on October 18th on Ninja Tune. The album is told through a series of interludes. The intro, a few interludes, and the outro explain the theme of the album, which is twofold. One, I wanted to give my parents their flowers while they're alive. And so much of my identity is being a daughter and their daughter. I used to write little handwritten notes to them, telling them how much I love them. And I used to sign the notes love, D-O-T-R, because I'm the world's worst speller to this day. So they thought that was cute, and they still to this day, when they're writing me notes, that's how they spell daughter. And then also last year was an intense year. I had three really, really powerful women in my life pass away 1 month apart. And so, it was a lot of processing and a lot of grief, which is also, you know, really, really closely related to joy. So I wanted to write music for them that honored them and, made me feel uplifted through this process. And so, yeah, those are sort of the themes of Daughter.
I was wondering about the spelling of that, because I looked at it and I was like, okay, I'm probably going to assume it's something totally different. But now that I hear it and the story behind it, that just puts everything into perspective, and that's just such a beautiful way to honor them. I mean, that's absolutely incredible. Your music is pretty dope, I must say, and I've heard it in a lot of random places. Probably one of the crazier places I heard it, and in fact, the first thing I ever heard from you was Geodisco.
Oh, cool!
And then all of a sudden, I'm like, I heard it in a Taco Bell ad. How the hell did that even happen? Because, like, I remember thinking, like, who in the hell at Taco Bell is a house head? Someone must be.
That's so funny. Yeah, that was actually my first Taco Bell sync, was Geodisco, which was so fun. And they actually, Taco Bell just did I just did another sync with them for Feel, which is on, it's a single on the new album. And they actually made the whole commercial about me. Like, it's photos of me and images of me and my voice over this song. That was great. They came to me and they're like, we had this idea. And they've been so supportive, and they're an awesome company, really, really amazing company culture. And do a lot to support artists and my nonprofit Femme House. And I turns out I'm a huge Taco Bell fan. I also do genuinely love Taco. It's like the one fast food place that I eat at on the road.
Honestly, like, I'm pretty much a stickler with Mexican food. And I'm like, because I live in the Bay Area too, so it's like, you know, you tell me you go into Chipotle, I'm gonna give you a dirty look. But Taco Bell,
Have you been to Little Chihuahua?
No, what's that?
Oh my God, that's my. It's in San Francisco, and they have a burrito with plantains in it that is to die for.
See, I was gonna say, like, because, like, with Taco Bell, I always make the exception because it's, for me, it's like comfort food, and I've never gotten tired of it. You ever gone to Farolito on 24th and Mission?
No.
El Farolito, 24th and Mission. Someone told me this too. One of my LA buddies told me this too, but I had no idea. He said ranked best burrito in America.
Whoa.
I would say go try it, but they're always on hit.
Sick.
And Little Chihuahua, I will have to check that out. I'm always like looking for good like spots to eat too, so you know, big boys love their food. So I do want to talk about the song So Nice to Be in Love, because that was the record that really like pulled me in back to your music hardcore, and now I'm like obsessed with everything you're putting out, because that song just hit really hard for me. Like I love the vibe. It kind of gives me like French house vibes in the best way possible. And I was actually wondering, was there a bit of Culture Club inspiration behind the chords in that song?
Interesting. I've never really listened to Culture Club. I would love to hear the song that you're referring to, though.
There's a song called, it's one of their best two, Miss Me Blind. Okay. And if you listen to the whole thing, there is a part, I believe, in the bridges. It's the exact same piano chords that run through So Nice to Be in Love. That dun, dun, dun. It's the exact. And when I heard it, I was like, I'm mashing this up. Or, you know.
Yeah. So Nice to Be in Love was built around a sample. So, you know, maybe they sample, because it's from the 50s or something. So maybe they sampled this original song. Who knows?
It very well could have been an inspiration for that. I mean, how did you come about making that song? Because also the piano intro is beautiful, too.
Aw, thank you. So I learned how to play the Grieg piano concerto when I was in high school, which is a 26-page whopper of a track. The beginning of that, of the Grieg piano concerto, sounds a lot like the beginning of So Nice to Be in Love, which is actually part of the sample. I worked on this with Miscolo, who I just signed to my record label, Yes, 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 and who's an incredible producer. And him and I were in the studio and messing around with some samples that my publisher had sent. And we loved So Nice to Be in Love, like the vocal hook. But as we kept listening through, we saw this piano part, and we just started freaking out and knew that we had to put that at the beginning of the track.
That's the one I've been rocking at. Like, I do a First Friday event in Berkeley, and I've been rocking that one like for like 3 or 4 months straight, and like it just sounds so good in the daytime. It's such a beautiful like daytime record too. But
you'll be excited, the French house reference. You'll be excited that Busy P is making a remix for it. So very, very French house. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Alan Broxay was up there with Falcon up there like right before I came over here. So I was like getting a bit of like French house like thrown into me, and it felt so good. I was gonna note that, you know, you are quite the accomplished pianist, and you're also a really dope DJ. So as someone who was not a very well accomplished piano person myself, because I, as a child, I think I had like a number of lessons, and I had this teacher that was not really the best. And every time like I would mess up, she'd bat my hands like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, every single time it would be like bat with like a ruler. And so I was like, Mom, I don't want to do this anymore. But DJing I picked up when I was about 20, and I got really good at it, and so I've been doing that ever since. Is it harder to learn how to play piano and be great at it, or DJing? Because they're both very complicated things to learn and master.
They're two totally different skill sets. The opposite ends of the spectrum. Both equally hard to be the best. You know, you can sit down and, like, you can hit your finger on the piano and you can make something happen. You know, just the same as you can go and hit play on a CDJ. But to be really, really proficient in both of them, I think, takes equal skill development. Just, you know, for different things, and I think they're both equally important. And I just, to touch on your piano teacher thing, I think the best thing, well, I always say I won the lottery twice, once when I was born to my parents, and once when my parents found me my piano teacher, Carolyn Horn, and I studied with her from second grade all the way through graduating. She's one of the women that passed away last year, and she was everything to me. She's the reason I'm sitting in front of you talking about music. And so one of the songs and interludes is dedicated to her. It's the first song I've written in a major key, but the power of a good teacher, I mean, she changed my life. She held up a mirror that made, you know, that said you're enough, and that you can do anything, and that you're powerful. And she cultivated creativity above anything else. We played the inside of the piano some days, or we just dance and play the bongos. And I mean, she's just, I just wish that every kid could have a teacher like that.
Sounds amazing. I mean, yeah, teachers are truly heroes, and you know, I always, they should be paid a lot more than just in general from what they get paid currently and throughout. When I found out what teachers make, I was just like, you gotta be kidding me. Not only for the fact that they have to put up with us, you know, bratty children, but like, you know, and they're also like cultivating our minds and taking us to the next level. So
totally.
This is an interesting one. So you remixed Jerry Garcia. Now, I have to know, are you a deadhead or are your parents deadheads?
I am now a deadhead. When Trixie Garcia and the estate that runs Garcia, when they approached me to do this remix package, I wanted to do it as, paying homage to my family, because growing up in my house, Jerry Garcia's voice was like an uncle's voice. You know, it was home to me. The Grateful Dead were home to me. And so I loved listening to them because it made me feel like calm my central nervous system when I'm touring and stuff. But I thought it would make them happy. And so I took on the project. And as I was listening to each individual stem, you know, so Jerry's guitar, just his voice, the drums, the piano, like everything separately. And, you know, in college when I was studying jazz piano performance, a lot of the work that I would do was transcribing other jazz artists. And that's how you really learn. So I was doing a lot of transcriptions for Jerry, trying to figure out, you know, what to sort of build around these amazing guitar parts. And that's when I really discovered that he is a genius. And I started appreciating him on a whole other musical level. And then also when I could hear everything separately and then all together, the music just made more sense to me. And I've always, before this and through my parents, I've always appreciated their live show and how they conduct it and how, you know, it's improv. I mean, I'm a jazz artist. Like, I really love that part of it. But I now am just, I'm just blown away by the musicality.
Yeah, it's fun fact, the station that I work for, we are very in love with Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. We have a show that comes on Wednesday nights, long-running show, very popular show called Dead to the World. And once a year, we have a Grateful Dead marathon. So it's like one of our year-round highlights.
How long does the marathon last?
All day. It's like 12 hours at least, I think. Actually, the last one might have been a full-on 24.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, you could go months and months with just replaying their shows.
Yeah. I mean, just the blanket of music that comes from his legacy and the Dead legacy, and like it's like a very much a Berkeley staple. I would think of, like, if you went to Cal, you probably would have seen some old Grateful Dead posters up at like Fat Slice or something, you know, just getting pizza.
And when I was at UC Berkeley, I was reading Phil Lesh's book, and Phil Lesh lived on the same streets that I lived on. Probably not the same building, but right, the same cross streets, and there's a lot of references to places that I was going when I was there, and it's a really special place for them and for all of us deadheads.
And then in terms of jazz, like, are we going to see like some straight up jazz cuts on this album that you're putting out, or is it mostly like in the vein of like dance music, house music, etc.?
I would say the jazz influence comes in my chords. You know, there's a lot of seventh chords. There's a lot of my sort of chord loops are always more than four beats. You know, some of the progressions are 16 to 32 bars on this album. So there, that, you know, it's not jazz, but influenced in that way. I would say where I like really lean into the jazz is during the live shows when I'm playing the piano on top of what I'm DJing. That's sort of more where I'm...
I really do like the piano aspect of your shows, too. I've seen a bunch of videos of you at different festivals, and you got the giant piano. And in my mind, I start to think, God, I wonder if you've ever, like, been so caught up in the mix of one or the other, you forget to, like, go back to the music while you're just rocking out on the piano.
Oh, absolutely. That's for sure happened. That is one... And, like, and then the song will just end. I'm just, like, out there jam. But actually, those... That makes a really cool moment, you know, because then the music is gone, and I'm having to, as I'm, you know, on the right hand, like, trying to figure out the next track to play and bring, and it's a fun, you know, that the mistakes are, like Miles Davis said, if you play a wrong note once, it's a mistake, but if you do it multiple times, it's intentional. So, you know, I lean into that when those moments happen.
Yeah, DJ mistakes are always interesting. They've happened to me more times than I can imagine, and I have DJ nightmares every once in a while, like where you can't, like, you're trying to get to that next song and you can't find it, and you're just scrolling and scrolling, and you're just like, I don't know if you ever had weird DJ nightmares like that.
I have not, actually.
Yeah, you don't want them.
I've had a have nightmares, but not about DJing.
Eventually, it's going to happen where you're going to end up having like a weird, like, it'll be you on a stage and something's not working and you've done it a million times, but for whatever reason, it doesn't want to work. And
that's happened in real life for sure. Yeah.
What's the weirdest thing that's happened at like either a concert or festival that you're just like, oh?
I mean, I use a DJS 1000 that I brought my piano into so that I can live sample and loop my piano. And I was playing a show with Scream, who I love, and at Movement Festival, which is a big deal. And the DJS, it was doing this like weird MIDI output thing, which I didn't even know that you could do. And so I was freaking out, like trying to fix it. And my tour manager, luckily this guy, he came and fixed it. But it was like, it was the first 20 to 30 minutes of just me freaking out.
Yeah, I remember seeing the Grimes incident like last year at, was it Coachella? And I remember thinking to myself, it's like, okay, she's probably faking it up there. But you know what? Any DJ that's been up there long enough will tell you we've had moments where something goes wrong. Yeah. Something is bound to go wrong. And you just, you know, you handle it the best way you can. And yeah. You know.
I was actually playing Red Rocks, and somebody in the backstage area was walking, you know, behind me, and tripped the power, and so killed all the power to the CDJs and the piano. Oh, no. So in the middle of a song, so you know, it happens.
Just don't let drunk people like try to knock down your equipment if you're in a boiler room kind of setting. That's too intense for me.
My dad always says it's not what happens, but what you do with it. So.
One more thing to talk about. You had a collab with Portugal the Man, one of the singles that's out. Any other collabs coming out that we should be aware of? And how did the one come about with Portugal the Man? Like, was that a really hard like thing to pull? Because I mean, they're very established, but it seems like you got a lot of pull. So,
Let's see. First of all, they're amazing. They are my favorite band. They're my so it is a pinch me moment that they're on the album. I truly can't believe it. I did a remix for their manager reached out to see if I'd want to do a remix for their on their last album, and which was like the most exciting thing ever. And I was so overzealous that I delivered them two remixes. And I just, you know, like to make sure that they would pick one, and they liked them both, and so they put them both out. And a few months later, I was touring in Chicago. I was playing a show in Chicago, and they were also playing a show in Chicago when they were on tour with Alt J. And so I came to their show, and then afterwards hung out with them on the bus for a little bit. We got to talk music and my favorite album of theirs, In the Mountain in the Clouds. And I was just euphoria for me. And then they came with me to my DJ set late night. And were just like so fun to hang out with. And so we became friends and would send each other ideas back and forth. And John, the lead singer, sent me Bittersweet, the vocal. And I was just, and like in some of the Mellotrons that you hear. And I mean, it's one of my favorite songs. He's so brilliant. I just couldn't believe I got to work on it.
Any other collabs to expect on the album coming up?
Yes.
Anything you can mention, or is it all top secret till then?
I mean, the one we just released, the Alabama Shakes, Brittany Howard, that was obviously a dream come true. There is a woman named Danielle Ponder. She is. Well, I first heard her, Blessed Madonna has a track with her, and I was playing that track out, and I assumed that Blessed Madonna had sampled a 1950s jazz singer, because they're just like, there's no singers that can sound like that today, like just the emotion, the melody choices with her voice, you know. And then I was working on the album, I was sending my publisher some demos, and he said, hey, you know, Danielle Ponder might be into this. And I was like, Danielle Ponder is alive? And I freaked out. And he's like, yeah, like she's making some amazing current music. So she came into my studio, and she's just one of a kind. She laid down this vocal that was like, it's the most unbelievable jazz riff that I've ever heard. It brought me to tears immediately. And so that would be the lead single on the album is with her. Yeah, and then there's a few other ones. So yeah.
And then finally, do tell me, Femme House. Please explain that to me, because I know you said there was an organization that you started.
Mm-hmm. It's a nonprofit, a 501c3 that I co-founded, and it teaches women how to produce music. There's only 3% of producers are women, so we aim to change that number through free workshops and online courses, as well as we partner with various promoters to do Femme House stage takeovers, and so we can book more women on the lineups, because it's hard to be what you can't see. So it's a full-time gig for me, though, and it's really the thing that keeps me going. It's my why.
There is a lot of talent in the Bay Area, so you got to do like some stuff for the Bay, and like maybe being us a 501c3, we can easily help promote that via like, you know, PSA and get the word out, just because that's right up our alley.
We're doing a free in-person workshop at UC Berkeley right before my show. I play in the Fox Theater in November, and so we're going to be doing a Femhouse workshop before that, free, open to everybody. We'd love to get the word out and have people come.
Yeah, I think we can definitely make that happen and get some attention to that. And then again, the album drops, it's coming up in like a week or two, right? October?
Yeah. October 18th.
Daughter, make sure you all go pick that up, because I'm excited for it. So LP, thank you so much for taking the time out. I really appreciate you. You guys were like pretty much probably ready to get out of here. You had to venture all the way back through this crazy place.
Sets in 3 days is a lot, so I think I'm gonna go take a little nap before the next one.
Yeah, definitely a nap is well deserved. Or you know, go to 24th and Mission and hit up Farolito and hook yourself up, because it's the best burrito for my money in this Bay.
You go to Little Chihuahua, you gotta try it out.
Oh, I'm definitely down. I'm definitely gonna go check it out.
Down the street from the Independent.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I'm all for that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, LP Giobbe, the album Daughter, available now. Now, being pressed, I couldn't see all of the performances, but the few I did catch were insane. I managed to see the group Fuckers, who've been on my list of artists to watch out for. I also caught Lava LaRue, Braxay and Falcon, and Disclosure, who ended my second day there on a high. I hope to go back next year and cover the event again, as it was truly a unique experience that gave me lots of fun memories and some very tired feet. For KPFA Area 94.1, this is Mike Biggs.